This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Overall, we're looking about probably in the vicinity of about 20% of species within any particular given geographic location disappearing by the end of the century.
That is Australian biologist Corey Bradshaw, professor of global ecology at Flinders University, Adelaide. Corey returns to Radio EcoShock with this update from the real world of living things.
They've said that there'll be a 7.22% fall in GDP by 2100 from a 3.2 degree increase in Celsius in temperature. What they're doing is really saying you can find the footprint for global warming and current data. And that's just nonsense, because it's a cascading effect and it's the runaway process that we are now very, very close to triggering. That is the really scary thing. The complete structural breakdown of our climate will occur over the next 80 years. And all these predictions are just nonsense.
Then, why do top economists claim global warming over 3 degrees will cause only minor damage to the economy? From the Analysis.News podcast, Colin Anthes interviews Australian economist Steve Keen about crazy numbers from the people who advise governments, banks, and business. I'm Alex Smith. It's all voices from Down Under this week on Radio EcoShock. Children born today will see literally thousands of animals disappear in their lifetime as global food webs collapse. That is a quote from new research by two established scientists. One is European Commission-affiliated scientist Dr. Giovanni Strona. The other is our guest, Professor Corey Bradshaw at Flinders University. From Adelaide, Australia, Corey Bradshaw, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Good to be back.
Yes, well, I think we should begin by introducing the idea of co-extinction. What is that, and why are we just kind of learning about it now?
Well, co-extinction, the concept has been around for quite some time. I mean, theoretically at least, going back probably over a century, it's kind of one of the fundamental aspects of ecology is that all species are, of course, connected in some form. No species lives in a vacuum. They all depend to some extent on other species, just like human beings depend on, you know, all the species we eat and the species that take care of our ecosystem services, like producing oxygen, for example, or purifying our water or sequestering our carbon. So we all depend on living things within the biosphere. So co-extinctions, they're really actually quite simple. If a particular species goes extinct and then all the species that depend on that species cannot shift their relationships, whether that be whether it's something they eat or another resource they gain off that species, they too will ultimately go extinct. So it's this idea of an extinction cascade, or co-extinction is the term we're using here. So it's only really been in the public eye really in the last few years, because we've realized that many of the forward projections about future extinctions don't really take into account this aspect of extinction cascades or co-extinctions.
And you and Giovanni also talk about edge species. What are they? I looked up edge species, and they are, you know, those that are at the strange ends of the evolution spectrum, you could say.
I don't think that's the definition we're using here. Let me just, we actually use edge in two ways. One is, it's actually, an edge is considered the interaction within a network, so the relationship between two species. The other aspect of edge is the limits of a species' particular tolerances to its environment. So in this case, we're using primarily precipitation and temperature. So it's the edge of their niche, if you will. So what they can withstand, their physiological capability. So that's how we're using it in this context. From like network terminology, that is beyond even ecology. I mean, we've stolen a lot of the network principles from computing, IT, and physics, which we've adapted to biological systems. But the terminology used to talk about the connection between two modes is an edge as well. It's a little bit confusing.
According to your comprehensive analysis, what is the best and worst case scenario, in a nutshell, for extinctions this century?
Well, overall, we're looking about probably in the vicinity of about 20% of species within any particular given geographic location disappearing by the end of the century. So what that looks like is, in reality, we're not talking about extinction per se. Extinction is the loss of all individuals within a species. We're talking about biodiversity loss. So this is, for example, you look out your window today and you count the number of animal species that you see. And then you look out that same window in 2100 and you count the same number of animal species. On average, you're going to see about, well, the exact number we came up with is about 17.6%. So about 20%, or one in five species disappearing. So that's about double what we had anticipated previously from climate change by just looking at the thermal tolerances, that is how much temperature extremes particular species can withstand before they go extinct.
So it's the interrelationship of animals that create a kind of a feedback effect that make extinction higher than we thought.
Yeah, well, you can think about it like this. Let's say, the obvious one is predators and their prey species. So if a particular predator specializes on eating a particular prey species, and it's not a generalist, as we say, it can't just eat whatever's going. It tends to specialize on particular species, and most predators are, in fact, quite specialized. Then if the prey species go extinct, then the predator has nothing to eat because it doesn't have the time to evolve a response to a different sort of diet. So it goes extinct. And really the timing is key here because over evolutionary timescales, of course, things wax and wane, and if there are slow changes, evolution can kind of take over and adapt the species to the new situation. But the climate change is happening so quickly that most species don't have much time to adapt. There is some adaptation, but it's very small. And we've actually coded in that adaptation into the model. But now you can think of other relationships like pollination is a great example. So many flowering plants have very specialist animal pollinators, mostly insects. You know, some birds, some bats, that sort of thing. But if those specialist pollinators, and many pollinators only pollinate a few, if not one species of plant, if those pollinators go extinct, then the plant can't reproduce, and ultimately it'll die out, and it can't, you know, make any new individuals for the next generations. Or something else that probably goes by the wayside for many people is parasites and their hosts. Parasites usually tend to be very host-specific, and if the host dies, then all the parasites that depend on that host will also go extinct. Now, a lot of people think that that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, who wants parasites? But parasites are kind of fundamental aspects of many ecosystems, and without them, we wouldn't have the same diversity that we have today. And it turns out that probably many of the big extinction events that have happened in the past, a large part of that has been the loss of parasites, which has really taken biodiversity and knocked it on the head.
So as I see it, you created a model to test responses by a representative cast of vertebrates to different levels of climate change. And it almost sounds like a game with virtual animals, but a lot of math in the engine. Is that a reasonable description? And can you cross-check this study with what happens in the real world?
Yeah, so obviously a model is an abstraction. One of my favorite quotes is from the late George Brooks, who's a biostatistician. He said that all models are wrong, but some are useful. So all models are by definition an abstraction or a simplification of a complex universe. But what they try to do, if they're useful, is to garner the main tendencies within a system. And models really only become useful when they're used in a comparative sense. So we contrast one future scenario with another, and we look at the relative change. It's not saying that this or this will happen. It's just like this is much worse than this situation, for example. So, yes, it is an abstraction. We don't, each of the individual species therein are actually not linked exactly to every species on the planet. We are making virtual Earths, but we're not doing an exact replica of Earth. We still don't have the data or the computing complexity to be able to do a completely virtual Earth, but we can get the main dynamics pretty well. And one of the ways we validate that is to look at the inherent distribution of diversity on the planet in a spatial sense derived from the primary inputs of the model. And it turns out, based on real data, that we can actually put the actual pattern of biodiversity, relative biodiversity, that is the number of species per unit area, across the entire globe really, really well. So we kind of know that this system is operating in a realistic sense. We're also using real data to look at this, for example, the distribution of species in different groups of animals, also in how they adapt to their environment. So this adaptation aspect, their dispersal rates, the proportion of species in different levels of a food web, for everything from the top predators right down to the herbivores. Now, where we don't have great information is the dynamics within the plants and the invertebrates. That's mainly due to the fact we don't have great data on those kind of linkages between those different groups and then their linkages to the vertebrates above them. So our model actually assumes that the primary resources, that is the plants and the insects, are inexhaustible, which is not the case, actually. So you can take our predictions as actually quite conservative, because if catastrophes happen really at the bottom of the food web, and the plants in particular, we vastly underestimated the extinction rates, and that's even scarier.
So we hear a mass extinction event could be developing right now, and then we go back to our lives and social media feeds. Humans just don't grasp this situation well. Could you paint us any photos of what living through a die-off would be like?
Well, the way I describe it to many people is that the future is not going to be very nice. It's actually, the term we use is ghastly. Now, that's an evocative and emotive term, but it basically means that our lifestyles and our standards of living will plummet, and they already are starting to plummet for many people in the world, especially the people with the fewest resources. The poor are getting nailed the hardest by climate change, for example, climate refugees, warfare, loss of food production, that sort of thing. Lots of suffering, ultimately lots of death, and really a poorer standard of living for all people. Now, the wealthiest will be buffered from that for some time, and that's probably why we don't hear a lot about it, is because that buffering is happening as we speak, but those are the people that kind of control the media. We, the wealthy people of the world, even though we're a minority, control most of the information flow. So until it affects us directly, and, it is starting to do that, both in terms of, say, for example, floods and bushfires, extreme heat waves. It's starting to sort of trickle through, but the severity of the implications down the track haven't even begun to hit home with the people that control the information flow. Now, we try as we might with, scientific endeavor to educate people about the severity of this. It's in a lot of ways, I remain pessimistic that most people won't do much until the crunch actually happens.
You list five dominant drivers in this sixth mass extinction: land use change, overharvesting, pollution, climate change, and biological invasions. I'll bet most people put land use change first, like burning down the Amazon, as the number one cause of extinctions. What did you find?
There's no question that in the past, especially in the last few hundred years, and the massive expansion, especially of European colonization around the planet, the main driver has certainly been habitat loss, cutting down forests, turning plains into agricultural areas. Those have been the primary drivers of species loss up until quite recently. But climate change will take over that loss. We've included in these particular models projected trends in continued habitat loss right to the end of the century. And it turns out that that's actually quite a minor component of the overall extinction rate once you take extinction cascades or co-extinctions into account. Now, that is surprising some people, and to be honest, during the review process, it even surprised our reviewers. But when you think about it objectively, much of that legacy effect, so the previous extinction and the extinctions that will happen because of past deforestation due to something we call extinction lag. So often you'll get, for example, an area that's deforested, a lot of those species will die immediately, but a lot just sort of move into smaller patches. Ultimately, they're doomed, but it takes many generations of those species. And if you can think of it, a long-living tree, for example, generations can be measured on a century scale. It takes some time for those extinctions to be realized. So we're still living the legacy of past habitat loss related extinctions, but if they haven't already, they will very soon be taken over by climate change because of these extinction cascades.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the Matthew Flinders Professor of Global Ecology, Corey Bradshaw. We are talking about wildlife disappearing as this century unfolds. Corey, you've published and spoken on the dangers and costs of invasive species, and Australia, biologically isolated as it was for so long, is particularly at risk, and there's been some bad examples, the rabbits, the cane toads, we could go on. So with global business and travel, humans are mixing in large cities, but is globalization a good idea for the other species?
Well, it's not a good idea for other species nor ourselves. I mean, we've done some work recently showing that invasive species cost the planet somewhere in the vicinity of several $100 billion a year, and that's increasing. So just in terms of gross economics, damage to crops, the cost of managing invasive species, the precipitations through the loss of other species, native species that are useful to us, have direct economic detriment. And I'm really, when I'm saying hundreds of billions, I'm not exaggerating. So the other aspect that invasive species do is, of course, they weaken native ecosystems and the connections between species because they tend to simplify those systems. So they can replace some of the functions of lost native species, but generally speaking, they take over components of those ecosystems and dominate them, which makes them overall less resilient to disturbances. So invasive species actually make everything else worse. Now, we weren't modeling invasive species, so you can look at our work as taking some of the two main drivers of extinction, putting them together, so that's climate change and habitat loss. But happening over top of all of that are things like pollution and invasive species and over-exploitation that contribute even more to extinction. So as I said earlier, our models are actually extremely conservative from that respect.
Is the issue of invasive species separate from climate change?
Yes and no. There's no direct there's no necessity for an invasive species, its dynamics to be related to climate change, but many species do respond to it positively. For example, the movement of tropical species into temperate zones, let's say insect vectors of diseases, malaria, dengue, that sort of thing, they can expand their ranges, and many invertebrates are in fact expanding their ranges because of this warming effect. So we're tropicalizing many parts of the temperate world, and the tropics harness more species, but they tend to be dominated by those that are the most generalist and that have the most damage. So climate change can facilitate invasion of alien species, but it's not a necessary part of the invasion process. Most invasions actually happen from direct or indirect introduction by humans through commerce.
Your virtual world also finds species get smaller as the world gets hotter, and I have heard that from other science. Does that mean, though, that we lose the large iconic animals like elephants or bears first?
Yes. Those species tend to have very large ranges to garner the resources necessary to maintain those large bodies. So there's a really good relationship between the size of an animal and the area over which it roams, and that's really just so that it can gain the essential resources it needs to complete its life cycle. So if resources are limiting in any sense, they become the first to drop off the perch because they can't complete their life cycles. Now, if you're smaller, there's one advantage of having a smaller area in which you are required to garner those resources, and you can withstand certain perturbations that might affect larger species more intensively. But the downside of that, of course, is that if you're restricted in range, one small disturbance event, for example, like a bushfire or a cyclone, can wipe out your entire population or the only population left in the entire species, which means that you're susceptible to these random events that wouldn't necessarily knock out a species that's spread over a much larger range. So it's kind of a balancing act. This is why we have both large and small species that have evolved, because there's a certain advantage under certain environmental conditions, either to being big or being small or anything in between. This is the diversity we have on the planet. But when things change extremely rapidly, as we are today, and due to entirely the human endeavor, the bigger things tend to drop off the perch first, yes.
Why do you and Giovanni Strona say, quote, the bleakest time for natural communities might be imminent?
We said that because some of the processes that we modeled, their starting points were actually within the next few decades, if not even this decade. So the processes that ultimately lead to co-extinction are starting now. So the more we can limit the changing temperature profiles now, the less likely co-extinctions will occur in the future. So one of the interesting components of the model is actually the middle range climate projection scenario based on an emissions profile that's sort of mid-range from what we expect over the next few decades at least, is the scenario where actually had some of the highest co-extinctions because the very high intensity warming scenario, more species went extinct from primary extinctions. That means exceeding their thermal tolerance. In other words, we had already lost those species, so there were fewer species to lose from these cascading effects. So really, it's about stopping the cascade early on in the series, because otherwise we're going to not be able to get a handle on this sort of runaway extinction cascade thereafter.
Many of our listeners worry about collapse and resiliency. In your new paper on the extinction crisis, you remind us of a 2016 paper by Strona. It suggests life systems that look strongest may actually be the most fragile. And that sort of reminds me of the collapse of the Soviet Union or the Lehman Brothers, which we never thought was possible. But in Living Affairs, what does Strona's work say about surprises in the survival of animals?
I think a lot of Giovanni's work and our own together suggests that it's really difficult to predict what a collapse might look like or how many connections must be lost in a complex system before things collapse. Even collapse is kind of a loaded term because it depends how you define that. Is collapse simply a loss of overall function? Is it a loss of diversity? Or is it wiping out the entire community? There's various interpretations of what that means. But I'll come back to the current paper. We did find that the number of connections within these systems actually dropped more than the number of species being lost. In other words, you think about it like a latticework or scaffolding. You know, you can knock out bars here and there, and the scaffolding still stands up. And up to a point, it looks strong and it looks intact. But you knock out, that last bar, and the whole thing will start to crumble. We don't really have a good handle on when that happens, but we do know that when you knock out bars from the scaffolding, you weaken the entire structure. That's why we have, the entire thing intact to begin with, so that it withstands those kind of shocks, like, wind coming along or some, earthquakes or whatever that might knock that scaffolding down. The fewer bars that link up the pieces that exist within that scaffolding, the more likely it is to collapse under another kind of disturbance.
And now we have big foundations to save iconic wildlife. People do care about animals, and some of these foundations work to create protective islands of nature for tigers or butterflies. But Corey, do they know about climate and co-extinctions?
Generally speaking, our conservation approaches are very much behind the ecological understanding. There are pushes within conservation biology and the conservation science in general to incorporate some of these. So there are processes and plans to do things called assisted migration, for example. So that's taking species that perhaps might be adapted to a particular area today, but in 50 years they won't be. So considering about moving species to anticipate the changing climate. There's also the idea of genetic rescue, and taken to the ultimate extreme would be genetic modification through things like CRISPR technology, where you can actually provide a genetic resilience to species by shifting species around and adding different genomes into populations. So there are aspects of this, but generally speaking, it's hard enough just to get an area put aside for species to conserve them, let alone anticipate all the future challenges that they'll face. That's extremely true on land. It's probably more flexible in the oceans, but even then, I think just the ability to make long-term plans is compromised by the fact that the wheels turn very slowly in commerce and economics.
You present startling numbers about the way things should go. Do you have any cautions about this paper and what studies are still needed to make us even more confident about this dark picture of extinction?
Yeah, a couple of things I've sort of alluded to over the course of the interview. One is getting a better handle on what's happening with the plants and the insects. You know, a lot of people are alluding to the loss of insects around the world. You know, you hear everything from insectageddon to, you know, catastrophic loss of all sort of main pollination services. We're not exactly sure what's going on because we don't have great data, unfortunately. And even though, you know, insects in particular make up most of the animal species on the planet, it's important that we really get a handle on how these interactions among species at the lower trophic levels are happening. And so we have to make the models a little bit more complex as a result of that. The other thing is to look at extinction per se and not just biodiversity loss. So that's taking into account the geographical distribution of species within these models and to try to anticipate the total loss of individuals from the species. In other words, extinction, as opposed to just a geographically specific loss of biodiversity. The final step, well, not final step, but certainly the third priority from our perspective is to do the same sort of modeling in the oceans, because we've only looked at the land surface here, and we'd like to incorporate the same methodology to look at extinctions in the seas. Slightly different system, both in terms of, you know, for example, dispersal is very different, but it has a lot of influences of oceanography that are a little bit more uncertain than our global circulation models. So it's going to be a challenge, but we need to get more data and more models, basically, to be able to get a real sort of robust picture of what's happening.
You've just made me think, well, extinction isn't everything. You kind of reminded me of COVID, where, yes, there's the death rate, but there's also all the people with long COVID. That's another kind of damage. So in the ecology, we may not lose all the wheat when a new rust arrives, a new disease, but we may not have enough to feed ourselves. So there's that damage stage as well as extinction that we need to be concerned about.
Exactly, yes. And this comes back to the idea of resilience. Just because a community still persists from, for example, climate change, it's vastly weakened because the number of linkages in there, the number of nodes in that system have also dwindled. So coming back to that scaffold analogy, it's weak, and therefore when another disturbance comes along, and you can think of disturbances in terms of things like bushfires, you know, the people are burning down as we speak around the planet in different parts of the world. We have floods. We've just had massive floods in Australia. We have cold snaps, which is something that the deniers will use to say that, you know, climate change isn't happening, but that's actually a prediction of many of the climate models, where the extremes are getting more extreme. So when these intense weather and climate events happen, they just give more opportunity for massive collapse within systems that are already weakened through these processes, these ongoing processes. So yes, if you have long COVID, you're probably more susceptible to other diseases, your immune system is compromised, and you might even die from secondary complications, for example, high blood pressure or some sort of pulmonary condition. So yes, we have to look at all the elements that perturb these systems and drive them towards a lower state of resistance.
Well, we've got to wrap this up. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
I think one thing that I try to do, I mean, my job, I'm a little bit like what we say in Australia, I'm a little bit like an ambulance driver, in that, you know, every day I come into work and it's doom and gloom and the messages are not very nice. And it's some people ask me, you know, why would I bother doing what I'm doing, knowing how awful things are? Well, the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning is thinking that, well, yes, the future is likely to be ghastly, but our decision on what we do today is going to dictate how ghastly that's going to be. So it's not a question of preventing future problems. It's damage control or mitigation. So if anything that I do can minimize that damage, accepting that damage is inevitable, that justifies what I do. And I think instead of giving up, people should have hope that they can contribute to minimizing that damage.
Less Worse is Better, that is where we are. The new paper is titled, Coextinctions Dominate Future Vertebrate Losses from Climate and Land Use Change. It's published December 16th, 2022. From Adelaide, our guest is co-author Professor Corey Bradshaw from the Flinders University in Adelaide. To find out more and find links to the paper and all sorts of other things, check out my show blog at ecoshock.org. Corey, thank you for helping us understand the way all this life works together.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciated the discussion.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Next, Exposing Apocalyptic Economics with Steve Keen, as posted January 30, 2023, by TheAnalysis.News.
You may have noticed that while natural scientists are focused on the ecological costs of climate change, social scientists and politicians seem much less concerned with the economic costs. According to renowned Australian economist Steve Keen, the reason is terrifying. Dr. Keen has been going through the works of the most mainstream neoclassical economists on whom our politicians base their projections and looking at how they're arriving at their numbers regarding climate change. He has found that they repeatedly confuse climate, the foundation of our energy and food, with the weather, with some of the biggest names even stating that 87% of the economy won't really be affected by climate change because the jobs are primarily indoors. This is such a fundamental and apocalyptic mistake that it leaves little room for reform. Dr. Keen argues that we must simply abandon these economists and their framework, saying it's us or them. Steve Keen has a history of calling out junk economics. He correctly and famously predicted the 2008 recession and spent the years leading up to the subprime mortgage crisis berating mainstream economists for failing to account for the role of private debt and credit. If he says we need to sound the alarm, we should probably pay attention. Steve Keen, welcome to The Analysis.
Thank you. That's a very good introduction. Very thorough.
I want to make sure that I'm framing your position correctly, because you're familiar with the pernicious influence of big money on politics and economics, but you're saying the problem runs much deeper than just corruption, and that's why we can't swap out the good neoclassical economists for the bad ones.
It is simply what they believe. People think that people who are critical of economics from the outside of the profession often think that economists are shrills for the capitalists, that sort of thing. I've seen that quite regularly on Twitter, of course. And that's getting the horse before the cart, because, in fact, training in neoclassical economics, if you accept it, if you believe it, ends up making you effectively a zealot for your vision of what capitalism is. And you will then you really have a belief in capitalism as the ideal social system, and therefore, if you see anything which challenges the sustainability of capitalism, there's an automatic tendency to reject it. And of course, that can benefit the capitalist class, but it's not why they do it. And this is what's happened in this particular case. No one paid William Nordhaus to assume that 87% of the economy would be unaffected by climate change because it happens in carefully controlled environments. That's his own attitude to capitalism, that it's just, you know, given their model of how capitalism functions, it's an infinitely flexible system, therefore it can cope with anything, therefore climate change can't be a problem. And that mindset is what has determined their the predictions they've made, which are so badly based that they should simply be thrown in the garbage bin. And that's, of course, what I'm trying to explain to policymakers and media and so on.
So let's take a look at what they mean by climate within these models and what, say, a natural scientist would call climate. Let's make sure we're not making the same mistake that they're making.
Well, to some extent, I think we can blame how climate is defined in conventional organizations like, for example, NOAA, the National Office of Oceanic Administration, I think it stands for, a wonderful acronym. I may have got the actual title there wrong. And they say that, you know, weather is what you experience on a day-by-day basis. Climate is the average of weather over a long period of time. And that really makes it seem, you know, that climate and weather are statistically different distributions, but the same basic data set. So, you know, weather's a particular day and climate's over a range of days. And that's fundamentally misleading. when it comes down to what climate change actually means. To me, I think about climate as the actual structure of the fluid flows in the oceans and the atmosphere of planet Earth. And to me, climate change, for example, would mean going from the three circulation cells that currently set the weather patterns in each of the two hemispheres of the planet, north and south hemisphere. So you have a cell where there's rising air at 0 degrees and falling at 30. That's the Hadley cell. Then you have what's called the Ferrer cell, which has falling and rising at 30 and 60, and then the polar 60 to 90. And that's why you have such substantial temperature differences between the tropics, the temperate zone, and the polar zone, and relatively consistent temperatures inside each of those zones. Now, if that flips over, and it has flipped over frequently in the Earth's past due to natural factors, of course, if that flips over to a single cell, then what you'll have is rising air at the poles and at the equator, and falling air at the poles, and in the middle, effectively, generally speaking, a drought, a desert. Now, that's climate change. And so that is a structural change to the patterns of fluid flows in both the oceans and the air that generate the weather we feel on a daily basis. And there's no way that there's it is not an average anymore. It's a complete change of the system that generates the weather. That's what climate change is.
Can you go through the disparity between the kind of description you've just given, the kind of description we might expect from a natural scientist, and the projections that these neoclassical economists are making?
Well, the description that the scientists are giving is existential.
Right.
If we exceed, and even they're saying they're giving vague numbers because, of course, this has never been done before, not only in the history of humanity, but also in the history of the planet. We've never had as rapid a change in the carbon dioxide levels as we're forcing on the planet right now. And of course, there are various structures which have evolved over time in our current climate, the Holocene climate, such as the Arctic having summer sea ice. So the Arctic reflects 90% of the energy that falls on it during summer. The Greenland, similar reflector of energy. Antarctica, the same in the southern hemisphere. The circulation patterns of the great ocean thermohaline circulation, which is an oceanic river, hundreds of times the volume of all the rivers, the continental rivers on the planet. So all those huge structural elements, that's the defining nature of the climate. And what scientists are saying is that if we increase the temperature by as little as 1 degree, we could trigger a breakdown in each of many of those characteristics of the current climate, and that would then cause a cascade. The scientists have been saying numbers like don't let it increase more than 2 or 3 degrees. The most recent paper by Kemp and co, I think in 2021 or 2022, came out saying 3 degrees is their limit for absolutely unsustainable temperature increase. But you see figures as low as 1%. We've already exceeded 1%. So the scientists are speculating, but they're all the speculations say anything above that level, you're talking about such a change in the climate that we could no longer sustain the sedentary human civilization we've had for the last 12,000 years. Our agricultural system could be destroyed, and therefore the carrying capacity of the planet could fall from the area of 8 billion as we currently have down to 1 billion if we're lucky. Now, that means 7 billion people die.
Wow.
So that's the scale that the scientists are talking about. Economists, on the other hand, are saying, and this is quoting Nordhaus, a 6-degree increase in temperature will cause an 8.9% fall in GDP compared to what it would be in the complete absence of climate change. If you look at the most recent IPCC report, Working Group 2, Chapter 16, is the economics chapter inside there. And that chapter said that a 4-degree increase in temperature by 2100, 4 degrees Celsius, could cause between a 10 and 23% fall in GDP compared to what it would be in the absence of climate change. And that therefore means they're assuming growth for the next 80 years, which would increase per capita incomes by a factor of 5. And they're saying rather than being 5 times as large, they'll be 4 times as large, which is trivial.
Wow.
So that's the difference. One is saying a minor decline in overall productive capacity while it still grows over time, where the scientists are saying we won't have a civilization past 4 degrees. Most scientists, I know, if you suggest 4 degrees level of warming, they're saying forget it. It's human civilization is over
right.
at that level.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's a disparity, all right?
Huge.
It's enormous. And I think for those who do not know who Nordhaus is and who some of these figures are, this is not a case of, say, big tobacco finding some fringe person somewhere who will accept a bribe to say something crazy. These are the most mainstream figures.
Yeah, well, so Nordhaus, first of all, he has taken over the mantle of publishing one of the dominant textbooks, Paul Samuelson textbook. He is now the continuing editor of the Samuelson textbook on economics. He was elected president of the Economic Association at some time in the last few years. I've forgotten when that actually was. And he got the Nobel Prize, so-called Nobel Prize for economics in 2018. So he's high status in the profession. And he... And a group of economists. It's only a very small band of economists, by the way. And this is one thing I try to emphasize to the profession. I say, for God's sake, ditch Nordhaus, because if you don't ditch Nordhaus, you'll be responsible for when the shit hits the fan and the shit is coming. You will be, economics in general, will be responsible for letting this garbage, and frankly, that's the only way I can describe it, this garbage get published. Because if you had decent refereeing of papers on the basis of the science of climate change being applied to these economic papers, none of them would have been published.
I want to delve a little further into some of the examples that you talk about as you go through the papers that these people have published, the statements that they've made. The 87% number that's given, one of them is about the Gulf Stream, which is absolutely terrifying. Can you go through some of the kind of extreme falsities that are being published on a very wide scale right now?
They have about four methods they've used to make up, and I emphasize make up numbers, okay? Mm-hmm. Not generate data, but make up numbers that then they say are related to climate change. So the very first was what they call the enumerative method. And the enumerative method, the way they describe it is that they take data from science papers and add up the damages that science papers say, and then you're adding up from the bottom up. So that's what they call the enumerative method. Now, when you take a look at Nordhaus 1991, To Slow or Not to Slow, The Economics of the Climate Change, published in the Economic Journal, which is published by Oxford University, certainly one of the top three or top five journals in economics in 1991. And then he said that there are some activities, such as microprocessor fabrication or open heart surgery, which occur in carefully controlled environments, that's literally a quote, which will not be particularly subject to climate change. On the other hand, there are other activities which are exposed to the weather and therefore exposed to climate change. He said, our estimate is that 87% of the American economy will be negligibly affected by climate change because it takes place in carefully controlled environments. Now that was when you look at the table here, which is table 15 in that particular paper, I think, it was all of manufacturing, all of wholesale and retail services, all of the finance sector, most of real estate, except for a small amount of coastal real estate. And he even included mining, apparently not being aware that a lot of mining is open cut and therefore exposed to the weather. So that is the scale of it. And you would hope that it would just be an aberration that got through, but later papers fixed it up. Instead, that was being maintained all the way through. And they don't use that method anymore, but that's one of the, they haven't rejected the numbers they got out of that. Now, when Nordhaus did his calculations, he had 3% of the economy being seriously exposed, which is largely agriculture and forestry, 10% marginally exposed. When he added up his numbers, he got a total of a 0.26% change in reduction in GDP for a 3-degree increase in temperature.
Wow.
Now, the reason he got that, because he, when it came to the section we said would be exposed, which is agriculture and forestry, he said he took into account the fertilizer effect of carbon dioxide. So he had somewhere between a plus 9.7 and a minus 10.5. And therefore, the average of the two is what he put in as the major source of damages. And that's where the 0.26% of GDP fall came from. And then he said there may be other factors that aren't included here. I might bump it up to 1%, but my hunch, and literally the word hunch in a so-called scientific paper, my hunch is that the damages will be no more than 2% of GDP from 3 degrees of warming. So that's one of their...
Wow.
Yeah, that's okay. And so that's a lot of those enumerative method ones come out with damages between positive, actually some of them think their fertilizer effects really good, you know, positive effects of up to 1%. And Richard Toll published one of those papers, down to about 2 or 3% fall in GDP. That's the range that they get.
Wow.
Second method they call the statistical method, and this is the very first paper that I actually saw, and I realized just how deluded they were on climate change. This is by Richard Toll in 2009, called The Economics of Climate Change. And in that paper, he described what he called the statistical approach, which is used by Mendelsohn, who's one of the research colleagues of Nordhaus. He said, Mendelsohn assumes that the variation of GDP with climate over space will hold over time. Now, what that means is Mendelsohn in this particular case, that at first, and initially just with America, they then generalized to a global distribution of income. But looking at, say, gross state products and average state temperature, you can then get this, and I've done this myself as just a simple exercise to show how stupid this is. If you take a look at the average temperature for every state in mainland America, continental America, and the average gross state product per capita, which is the state version of GDP, then you get a scatter plot. If you then graph the temperature on the horizontal and the income on the vertical, you get a scatter plot, which is a huge wide scatter plot. But if you do a quadratic regression on that, and they almost always use quadratics, what they call their damage functions, that quadratic will tell you that each degree increase in temperature reduces your GDP by about 0.3% times the temperature change squared. Now, that therefore means that a 10 degree increase in temperature will cause about a 15% fall in GDP. Huh. Ironically, that's a bigger number than Nordhaus himself uses. So his damage function is that the damage to GDP from temperature increase will be 0.227% times the temperature change. And that's where you get this, you know, 6 degree increase in temperature, about an 8% fall in GDP. But it's literally using the geographic nature of climate. So obviously the climate of Florida is different to the climate of North Dakota. Okay. But that's sitting inside exactly the same temperature distribution, the global temperature. There's no change in global temperature between Dakota and Florida because they're on the same globe. And they simply assume that very light variation, relatively trivial role of temperature in determining GDP, will be what climate change does over time. And the craziness of this is that and I've made this case for a research paper, a project I'm working on right now, the reason that you can have a successful economy in Florida and have a successful one in Dakota is they trade with each other. The stuff that North Dakota can't produce that Florida can, the stuff that Florida produces that North Dakota can't, part of the income is because North Dakota is selling products to Florida. Right. Now, you can't sell through time, okay? You can't sell wheat produced in 2020 to people in 2100. Right. So the whole idea that you can use what happens over space as an anagram, what happens over time, is just nonsense. And again, it's showing they simply don't understand what climate change actually means. Now, the third method has come along after that, and that is that acknowledging that mistake, some economists have said, well, we need to have data where there's change in temperature, change in global average temperature, and we then compare that to either GDP or change in GDP. And that's been done by a number of people. So there's a paper by Kahn and Mahadis and a few others coming out of the International Monetary Fund. And they have said, well, there's a nonlinear relationship at the global, at the geographic level between temperature and GDP. So they've worked out what that nonlinear relationship is for change in temperature over the period 1960 to 2014. I think that's the data set they use. And they've then extrapolated that forward 80 years. Now, that only works if there's no structural change to the climate over the next 80 years, which is nonsense, because they're talking about that. They said that it's a 1/25th of degree Celsius change in temperature per year, which mounts up to 3.2 degrees over the next 80 years, will cause about, a 0.05 decline in GDP for each year. And therefore, they're saying that There will be a seven, and I love the false precision they give. These are supposed to be statisticians. If you, this sort of false precision shows you're a child, you don't know really what you're doing. They've said that there'll be a 7.22% fall in GDP by 2100 from a 3.2 degree increase in Celsius in temperature. Now, they can't even get today's GDP accurate to 0.1%. And here they're trying to predict GDP in 80 years' time to two decimal places of accuracy. It's just nonsense. So that's the sort of thing there. But there's basically three methods. There's what they're doing is really saying you can find the footprint for global warming in current data, and that's just nonsense. Okay, because you know it's a cascading effect, and it's the runaway process that we are now very, very close to triggering. That is the really scary thing. The complete structural breakdown of our climate will occur over the next 80 years. And all these predictions are just nonsense.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Exposing Apocalyptic Economics with Steve Keen, as posted January 2023 by TheAnalysis.News. Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
I'm not a particularly religious person myself, but there's a church in my community that's a good actor. And so for several years, I volunteered on its committee as a community. And they were getting hit with thousands of dollars of new insurance costs because increased risk of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, this the climate instability we're seeing right now, the crazy cold temperatures in America, crazy hot temperatures in Europe, drought in California, now it's flood in California. That volatility is being generated by the extra energy that we've trapped in the atmosphere courtesy of carbon dioxide. So we're already seeing the real world couldn't give a damn about what economists think. The real world will do what the real world climate does under the energy pressure that we're putting on the biosphere. And that is going to make a laughing stock of the predictions of the economists, probably in this decade. But it's at some point it'll be bleedingly obvious that their damage estimates have got absolutely nothing to do with what's actually going on, and the damages are far, far higher. And in that situation, anybody who's trusted economists either directly or indirectly by accepting their damage assessments and then putting that to insurance contracts and so on, they're going to be forced to pay out an absolute fortune, and they'll be bankrupted by the cost of climate change damages.
If we want to be able to think about this critically and productively and not make the same mistake as them, what is a good starting point for us to think about what is the role of climate in the economy?
First of all, just to handle what sort of changes are being spoken about, what is feasible to happen if the temperature rises any further. And I'll give one of my favorite examples, because it's terrifying, and the person who's making it is impeccable credentials. So the professor of chemistry at Harvard University, J.G. Anderson, was the person who discovered the hole in the ozone layer in the last century and led the campaign to close the hole. So his argument in a paper published in 2017 is that with the decline in the Arctic summer sea ice, that will trigger a breakdown of those three circulation cells. And that will mean that storms which currently develop over the plains of America, the central plains of America, which are enormous storms, will penetrate the stratosphere. So at the moment, those storms are restricted to the troposphere, which are below 20 kilometers where we live and work. If it gets into the stratosphere, it will take moisture into the stratosphere. And the current of the stratosphere is very, very low levels of H2O, so it's a very dry stratosphere. When that water passes in, it will also carry in chlorine and bromide, partially from our own industrial processes, but also even from volcanoes. And that chlorine and bromide will increase, according to Anderson's paper, increase the rate of destruction of ozone by a factor of 100. Hmm. And what that would mean is it's no longer safe to go outdoors for humans, particularly. Other animals with fur, slightly better chances than us. Plants apparently have got a fair bit of protection against high levels of UV, but we won't be able to go outdoors. And I'm sorry, that's the end. That's the end of human civilization. If we can't, you can't go outdoors during daylight hours, then what happens to our civilization? It breaks down. So, and of course, people will die of skin cancer. So it's an appalling potential. Now, in that situation, if that's happening, you haven't got an economy. Right. And so that the existential stuff that I want people to realize is what we're playing with here. Mm-hmm. So that's the real danger. It's not a case of a bit of damage here, a few more percent insurance claims, stuff like that. It's you can no longer manage a human civilization. And you couldn't even manage hunting and gathering in that situation because you couldn't afford to hunt during the day. So it's existential. That's what I prefer to people to look at, rather than we're working in terms of percentages of GDP and damages and so on. That's the game the economists have played. And it's also a game of correlation, not causation. They have no theory as to how temperature causes GDP. They simply say, here's this correlation we've found in current data, and that's what we're going to use to predict the damages of climate change. It's completely irrelevant to what climate change will actually do to human civilization.
I'm going to ask you a tough question. Maybe it's too much for this interview, but my generation has never experienced a real recovery from 2008. COVID has caused more economic distress. We have major companies like Goldman Sachs is already laying people off in anticipation of another downturn. And we're having a conversation about how economists have wildly overestimated how good things are going to be. So is that we throw out these neoclassical economists who are making these terrible projections, if we put them aside and start to put a different theory in place, is there some feasible glimmer of sunlight that we can put in front of people to rally behind?
Well, the main thing is we have to drastically reduce the load we put on the planet in terms of the biosphere. So the carbon dioxide is the most obvious damage we're doing, but everything else we do as well. We're dumping plastics, which are damaging food chains throughout the world. We're intruding on what used to be virgin territory. So we're hitting up against, that's where the pandemic came from, the fact that we're intruding into areas which used to be, you know, off limits for humans. Now we're the best possible host for any pandemic. Why attack any other animal when humans are so prolific and distribute the diseases so well? So we're making ourselves a target for all these, you know, elements of the, you know, hostile elements of the environment in which we live. So there's the only glimmer would be to say, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to have to go into a catastrophe before we reverse direction. But what we have to say is we have to drastically reduce our load on the planet now, and that means a drastic fall in the consumption levels of the rich. And that can be both global rich, but also rich within each nation state. So it's not the poor who have to consume less, because even in the case of America, something like about 30% of people are living on the breadline, so you can't force them to consume less, but you have to make the rich consume less, and you have to radically and rapidly decarbonize the economy, and then you've also got to reduce our load on the planet so that we reserve at least half the planet for non-human life. And at the moment, we're using 97% of the planet. You know, the only part... only parts we're not using, the ones that it's simply impossible to use, such as Greenland and Antarctica and the tundra regions. But everything else we're exploiting to the hilt, and we have to say that no longer can be allowed. Now, I simply don't believe we're going to do it in time. Even if people in policy listen to me, which they won't do, they know how hard it would be to sell the sort of message I've got to the public. And if they try to sell that message before it becomes obvious as necessary, they'll lose their positions. So we won't do anything until we get absolutely obvious catastrophes that have to be blamed on climate change. Nothing else can be considered. And, for example, something like the breakdown of the ozone layer of the Northern Hemisphere, that would be a wake-up call. Now, in that situation, what you have to be, if you're going to have any chance of maintaining human civilization through this process, you have to have measures in place that give you a chance to react to whatever catastrophe will come along. So if the catastrophe happens to be a collapse in wheat production, and that's quite a feasible one from climate change, then you have to have reserves of grain already stored in case there's a collapse in the crops, and you have to have a rationing system. So if everybody gets the same ration, you don't have people starving to death because they can't afford to buy the grain. You've got to go from a monetary capitalist economy to a ration-based, war-based economy, effectively. But all these things are so gigantic that you have to be prepared to throw a level of our energy, our activity at the planet that will dwarf what we did during World War II. These are going to happen. Okay? The question is, are they going to be enforced upon us, or are we going to try to manage it?
That's not an optimistic note to end on, but perhaps it's the kind of bluntness that we need to deal with a real world with a real climate and not the imagined world of these neoclassical economists. Steve Keen, this has been a very insightful interview. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Colin.
My thanks for permission to broadcast this discussion with Australian economist Steve Keen. The host is Colin Bruce Antes. Check out theanalysis.news for more rowdy views. Find links and more comments in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That is all the time we have this week. I'm Alex Smith. Keep thinking, keep trying, and thank you for caring about this world, all of it.